All right. My guest today, Amanda, is an author, author of Divine Messy Human, a spiritual guide to prioritizing internal truth over external influence. So that's right in my wheelhouse. Some big philosophical topics there to discuss. But she's also a kinesiologist, a mentor, an archetypal life coach, a mother, and obviously much more. She describes herself as a recovering people pleaser, which I totally get, and someone who walks the path straddling the divine and the messy daily. And she picked self-mastery as her most important value because Amanda views it as always growing, developing, learning new ways of being. The best way to be yourself, hopefully, is the best way to one day leave the earth better than she found it. And there's something very pragmatic and practical in that value. I mean, in simple terms, if you can, quote unquote, master yourself, then you're better equipped to do whatever it is you set out to accomplish in the world, right? The better you know your values, your triggers, insecurities, passions, traumas, and all that stuff that makes us us, then the more efficiently you can kind of move through the world. And although that idea of self, right, being at the heart of it and the core of it, sometimes gets, you know, viewed as, is that being selfish? Is that too much focused on yourself? Is it self-indulgent? Amanda actually views it as one of the most generous things you can do, because once you master yourself, you can better interact and serve those around you. So as with many discussions we have on this show, you won't get much of an argument from me on the concept of that. I think a lot of that makes sense. And there's a lot of beauty to it, right? You do the work, you figure out yourself. If we all do that, it allows for a better world. But the question becomes, how do we make this real in everyday life, right? What does it actually mean to master ourselves? How do we go about even doing that? What role should the external input play into that process? Is it completely irrelevant, or is it something that we should consider? And is it true that our ultimate mission is to serve others, right? Just to name a few, those are some of the big questions that came up and we discussed during the show. And Amanda was totally game. I mean, she was able to talk about, given her work and her past experiences, at times struggling with her own identity. And as she said it, kind of feeling like an empty shell of herself, we were able to use that as kind of a real life use case to explain how this can work. And maybe what I found most interesting from a philosophical perspective in this conversation is that at the root of this approach to life is this deep faith in humanity. There's this belief that if we trust each individual to figure out who they are and what works for them, no matter what that might be, right? That external validation, external influence, remove that. Let people just be who they are. It will all be much better off, right? If we embrace that kind of self-love and acceptance of self, rather than the conditioning and the external validation, there'll be a lot more love to give in the world. And listen, I'd be lying if I said I had that same level of faith in humanity that Amanda does. But maybe that's just reflective of the work I still have to do on myself. But again, I think the concept of it, I think striving for that is something that we should all be considering and thinking more about. So big thanks to Amanda for being on. And with that, let's get to the episode. Amanda, thanks so much for being on. Really excited to talk to you today. I like to get right to it. So I'll jump right to the question of what's the value that's most important to you?
It was interesting. I used to go by the three values that people say, and end of last year, I narrowed it down to one, and it's self-mastery.
Interesting. That's the first. We haven't heard self-mastery yet, so I like that. I'm intrigued. Tell me a little about self-mastery. What does that mean for you?
So my last, I guess, probably 11 years now, I've been diving more and more and more into spiritual development, personal development, all of that sort of stuff. I guess it started with personal development and blossomed into spiritual development. And, you know, I went through different iterations of my values, and it was at the end of last year, I just went, you know what, I'm living to all of these values, but the most important one I'm living to is self-mastery. The more I understand myself, the more I can understand other people, the more I can understand the way I'm showing up in the world, the more I can be loving. Because if I understand myself and my own triggers and activations and my own behavior patterns, my own conditioning, then the more loving I can show up in the world. So that kind of ticks that box. You know, the more authentic I'm going to be, the more generous I can be, the more boundaried I will be, because I understand my own needs and wants. And so whilst it sort of in some ways feels like a very selfish, you know, way to think of self first, it is actually the most lovingly that I can show up in the world.
Super interesting. Yeah, I like the way you're explaining it. It's almost kind of knowledge or clarity on who you really are, what really matters to you, and what it's all about. So I guess the question becomes, like, what you started to touch on it, right? With some of the triggers and some of the things that might impact you, but what does self-mastery actually look like? Like, how do you know if you're achieving it? I assume it's kind of a journey, right? We never actually achieve self-mastery. You never finish line, right?
Hell, I think no.
That's kind of the first thing we learn. But what gives you a sense that you're starting to grasp it? What does it bring to your life that you feel like makes it so important and so worth it for you?
It's just been such a way of life for so long. You know, it started really because I got to a place where I thought I was just an empty shell of a human being, and I wasn't worth anything. And that really hit sort of 2015, 2016, more through 2015. 2016, I left my marriage, and I guess that's really when the work was able to begin, because I could look at myself as an individual without all of the other mess of, you know, our toxic relationship getting in the way and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. It very much became, who am I? Who do I want to be in this world? Is this all that I've got? You know, I didn't even know that, say, for example, I was passive aggressive because I didn't understand what it was, because most people in my life, that's how they communicate. So I just thought we were communicating. I didn't understand it. Now, through my kinesiology study, I learned about that kind of behavior, and I'm like, huh, there's all these other ways to be. And a lot of it did come through that kinesiology. It came through me understanding the emotions that were trapped in my body. It was the way that I was therefore behaving in the world. It was the trauma patterns and the trauma events that I'd been through that were influencing these behaviors, because my body thought that's the way I was going to stay safe in the world. That was the way I belonged. You know, me people pleasing was a way for me to belong in my tribe and have a place that was useful so that I could grow an adult.
On that, maybe a weird question.
Of course. Yeah.
How did you know, or how do you know that it was wrong, right? That you shouldn't be passive aggressive, that you shouldn't people please. That sounds stupid, right? It sounds like, well, obviously those are bad things, but some of them are defense mechanisms for a reason. Some of them,
of course, developed.
Maybe there's credit, you know, reason for it. How'd you know, like, yeah, I'm learning more about myself and I'm seeing that that's kind of an objectively bad thing.
Again, I guess it comes back into that. Is it a good or a bad thing, really? Can we put that value judgment on it? You know, because that is us, you know, standing almost in superiority of over those who use those forms. Now, again, for some people, that's just how they've learned to communicate. That was how I'd learned to communicate. Now, what I saw through my own exploration, through my own personal development work, through my kinesiology study, through the spiritual development work I was doing, I started seeing that there were more loving ways to communicate. There were more honest ways to communicate. There were more integrous ways to communicate. I always thought that I was an honest, open, loving person. And yet here I was communicating in a passive aggressive way because I didn't know, A, that I had needs, or B, how to get them met. So if you don't know what your needs are, you certainly can't get them met. And then you're feeling resentful because you know there's something that you want to be met that's not being met. And it just builds this way of being. And it solidifies this way of being. And so, you know, I would read more books, I would do more discovery, I would practice myself. I'd catch myself in the behavior going, is this really how I want to be behaving? How could I do things differently? You know, what led up to me snapping like this or behaving like this? Even now, you know, if I come in and I'm behaving unresourcefully in that kind of way, I'll sort of take a bit of stock and go, well, okay, what's been happening in the days leading up to this? Why have I gotten to a point where I think that that old behavior pattern is getting me what I think it's going to get me, which is not love and connection. It's usually she can piss off, you know, like it's certainly not going to draw my partner closer to me. And so, you know, I can therefore see more clearly how it has driven people away in the past because of that behavior. Because now that I'm not in that behavior pattern, I'm drawing people that are close to me closer. Not driving them away. I don't have the same walls up. I feel a lot safer. Therefore, I can be a lot more calm and considerate. Now, that doesn't mean I don't have strong boundaries, But instead of enforcing my boundaries aggressively, I'm able to stand on my boundary line and going, no, that's enough.
Mm. And that's a whole different level of confidence and peace and comfort. Because it's ironic, maybe, I don't know if that's the right word, but all those things you were doing were in some ways to allow you to feel confident and comfort and safe.
Yeah.
But ironically, it's actually the work you did to face it. That's the safest you can actually feel, is to just be confident in yourself, to have that self-mastery. And it's strange. Here's the thing I find interesting. I'm curious how you think about this. In some ways, it's so obvious and simple. Like, figure out yourself, figure out what you actually want, figure out what your triggers are, your issues, and start to like almost logically work towards what you want to get to. And if you want to bring better people in your life, you start to do that. All right. Yeah. People struggle with it so deeply.
Yeah.
It's such a hard thing for people to do. Why do you think that is, when it's seemingly such a simple exercise, such a simple activity?
Well, when we come into this world, we have been a soul being. So we are pure peace and love and joy and happiness. And we are part of the all that is. And then like this little piece of the soul comes down and is in this tiny, helpless little body that is growing inside its mother. And of course, then it still feels like part of all that is, because it's connected to something else. And then we get pushed out into the world and it's like, holy crap, like, I'm not the doctor and I'm not my mom and I'm not my dad and I'm not all these people around me. And we then go through this period of learning that we aren't everybody else. And so when we're crying, for example, and you know, you look at the parenting books of the 50s, 60s, 70s, actually, even when I first had babies in the early 2000s, the parenting books where you feed them on a schedule, they sleep on a schedule, you know, they fit into your life, control cry them, all of this sort of stuff. Now, all of that is encouraging disconnection from our kids. Now, with what I know now, I would be a completely different mother, but you know, this is the path I was supposed to walk. So I wasn't supposed to know earlier, but you know, what we're looking for when we cry as an infant is belonging, love, nurturing, nourishment. We want to know that we are an integral part of this tribe, that we are needed, that we are valued, that we are accepted. Not that we're a nuisance who needs to be put in a cot separate from everybody else and left to deal with it on our own. So we sort of start looking at the behaviors of our parents, of our siblings, of our community, of everything. And we're looking at how other people also interact. But these people were also raised in that way. So they've got their own trauma patterns from that. So you can sort of see how it all kind of, you know, gets a bit messy at this point. But then also our job physiologically is we need to live to adulthood. How do we do that? If we're not accepted by our tribe, because it is still that ancient DNA where we did live in tribes, all of us, that ancient DNA says, if I'm not accepted by the tribe, I'm going to be cast out into the wilderness and I'm going to die. So we look for those ways that we're going to be accepted in our tribe, that we are going to be accepted and loved. So we then develop behaviors that we see around us. And if we do something that doesn't get a positive reaction, we stop doing that thing as much as we can, or we hide that thing if it's an integral part of us. And so we have to look out when we're younger, because we need to understand behaviors that keep us included. Then obviously, you know, if something's wrong with us, well, we go to the doctor. If something happens at school, we're supposed to go to the teacher. If something happens at home, we defer to our parents. Yet as we get closer and closer to adulthood, we're not actually then untaught all of that conditioning. We're just sent out in the world and now you're on your own. You're an adult. So go fly. And it's like, what the hell? We're not taught any of the...
And then you pass it on to them and you do it over and over.
Exactly. Exactly. Until there are people who are breaking those conditioning patterns. Well, and that's what I find fascinating.
Well, I'm sorry to jump in, but I find fascinating as well. So let's spin that the other way and say that... You know, there's an argument being made today. I'm not saying it's the right argument, but that self-love, compassion, vulnerability, a lot of the things we're talking about are actually a bad thing, right? And let's give the benefit of the doubt for a second to some of those parents, whoever it might be, that are practicing that parenting style that we're saying, like, maybe not the best.
I think there's an argument to be made that they would say, which is that the world is a really tough, ugly, horrible place. Mm-hmm. And we need to teach our kids and prepare our kids for that in some way. And if we give them all that connection and all that comfort and all that love, they're not prepared for the world. So it might be nice and idealistic to say, you know, we don't let them cry at night until they fall asleep. But the reality is we have to do that for society to function, for them to mm-hmm. function in this interconnected society. They need to be able to handle all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Again, not saying it's right, but how do you think about that? Is there any credibility to that? Is there any argument to be made there?
Well, interestingly enough, I was actually listening to some work from Dr. Gabor Maté, and he is an incredibly informed trauma specialist. And all of the data that is out there basically disproves that. Mm. The reason we think that is because that's how we were raised. We think that we should be raising kids for a tough, ugly world. Yet what if we showed our children more love? What if we showed them that they belong and that they are loved and that they are cared for? And yeah, there are assholes out there, but that if you approach everybody with love, actually there's more love in the world. So therefore, is the world as ugly and horrible and hard as we're taught that it is? I actually believe that if we lead with that love, if we truly belonged, if we truly felt that we belonged, we would also be able to see those behaviors because it's not like we're separated from it. We still go to school, we're still mixing in it. But if we have that safe place at home, that soft place to fall at home, that place that is nurturing and loving and connected and supportive, and where we can explore our emotional state, where we can explore, you know, who we are, then we actually go out in the world with more heart, more love, more openness. And it's fascinating now that the data, you know, I mean, they prove science can be up to 18 years behind actually what's going on. And I find it really interesting that a lot of this trauma information is coming out now, and I was learning it 5, 6, however many years ago, because it's always been there. It's always been in the data. It's just that's not really convenient for us who are trying to live our 9-to-5 lives, and we're trying to still have our, you know, date nights and this, that, and the other. It's kind of inconvenient to have a baby basically, you know, attached to you, because, you know, then how do we go out and work and earn the money to have the things to, you know, so also we want the babies to fit into our lifestyle.
Well, and that's an interesting point, because you're right, because it becomes like a practical question of, and maybe that's at the heart of this. Maybe it's a philosophical question, maybe it's not, but like for us to achieve us, society, whatever you want to call it, rhetorical us, to achieve the things we've achieved, to innovate, to create, to develop all these amazing things, do we need to approach it that? Like, is it a binary choice that says we can embrace what the data is showing us, what you're saying, and probably have healthier, more well-adjusted kids, arguably happier kids, right? Maybe even we'd be happier as well, but we wouldn't achieve as much. It wouldn't allow, just practically, it would limit us more. And that's just an inconvenient truth that maybe we don't want to face as a society. So we like to think we can have both. The data, obviously, it seems to show us that we can't, but we refuse to accept that. Is there a truth to that, that we can't have both?
I actually believe we can pretty much achieve whatever we want in life, but we need to break down some of the I guess those belief systems that believe we can't. You look at how much has been achieved previously, and yes, usually there has been one parent at home or whatever, but I don't think we necessarily need that. You know, I've seen women working with their babies strapped to their chest. Mm-hmm. You know, why not? It's well, not, you know, it's like, that, do if it.
if we drill in on that, and I'm not saying this is true. We're asking the questions, right? Let's see where it takes us.
Oh, look, I don't know where it's going to go, and who knows? With well, society, right. Like,
that baby being strapped to the chest, somebody could say, yeah, that's that trying to make pretend you can have both. That's doing the work, but the baby somehow is being harmed in some way. And again, I'm not saying that's necessarily the case, but that's what I come back to. And that's why I like the approach you're saying to it is, let's look at it as clearly as we can. Let's just understand what it actually is and then act accordingly. And if we realize, you know what, and again, I'm not saying it's true, but we do need to change the way we think about the work-life balance and how we manage family relationships, and then we need to do that. But we'd be better off knowing the truth about it and acting on that than on what we hoped it was, or what we just assumed was right, because that's what generations before us did. And I think that's kind of the key part of it, is the truth.
Yeah,
is
definitely.
Whatever that is.
I think the thing is, we're all swimming in this society. So we're all wet. We're all in the water. But we don't know we're wet because we've always been in the water. Mm. So things are the way they are because that's how they are. Mm. Yep. And so until people start asking questions and going, well, hang on, is there a different way? That is how we innovate. That mm. is how we change things. That mm. is how we potentially go from this world that is, you know, sometimes very hard and unjust, potentially to a more loving, connected world. Mm. And breaking down those paradigms, you know, and it is that patriarchal system that we've been living under for, you know, 2,000 to 4,000 words. And again, that's no disrespect to, you know, men. I think it harms everybody being in this kind of society. It is all about power over. But if we start looking at power with other people and power to other people rather than trying to get power over, but that's where we're at is, and we're in that idea of scarcity that if I win, you lose.
Yeah.
You know, but again, I love the idea. Somebody told me about, you know, back in the day, if I had, say, 10 CDs to sell and you bought two, I would have less CDs and you would have more CDs. But now that we've got streaming, everyone can have all the CDs that, you know, songs they want. And nobody's getting less and nobody's getting more. And who would have thought that however many years ago?
Mm.
You know, like when I was a kid, that would have been weird, you know, weird, crazy sort of idea of technology. But people, you know, there are these ways clearly that we can cannot end up with less because somebody else has more. We just don't necessarily know what they are until they start being explored and questioned. And I love that. I think that's incredible.
I do too. Mm. And it makes me wonder though, like, what do you think, what changed in that? Is it technology change to where we're still wired the same way to think like we did hundreds, thousands, whatever years ago of scarcity, of survival, and technology has said, hey, you don't need to do that anymore. It's okay. Or were we wrong 100 or 1,000 years ago? We just weren't sophisticated.
Well, biologically,
but yeah.
Yeah, biologically, you know, if we go back to those kind of days, it was pretty dangerous. We lived in a pretty dangerous world. So biologically, we are trained to look for fear, to look for danger, because that's how we stay alive to adulthood. And we needed to be alive to adulthood, obviously, to procreate, to keep the race going. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, we're in a pretty, you know, for most of us, we live in a relatively safe environment. And I'm not saying safe as in, you know, we're not going to be eaten by bears. We're not going to be, you know, the biggest dangers actually come from other human beings, let's face it. Mm-hmm. And that human behavior, again, of trying to get power over. And so when we start to look at the fact that for the most part, we are actually safe, like in this moment right now, are we safe? There's nothing here that's going to harm me right now in this moment. And my body, I still remember, I used to completely almost dissociate from myself because I felt like I was not going to survive. Mm. I felt so under attack and so threatened that my physical bodily behaviors, I would shake, I was in a terrible state. And that was actually how I got myself physically out of it. I'd go, hang on a minute, am I safe right now? And I'd take a couple of big deep breaths. I'd come right into present moment. I'd be like, I'm actually safe. There is no reason for my body to be behaving like this. And I was able to change that physiology. But the fact is, we are tuned into still that idea that we need to look for the danger, we need to look for the, you know, uncertainty, we need to look for those things. And we're built to walk, you know, we're built to move at walking pace. So we're driving around at, you know, 60, 80, 100 kilometers an hour, taking in all of these messages. We're on, you know, flashing screens and we've got the bright lights and the sounds and all of this stuff going around, but we're built to move at walking pace through nature. And so again, we're trying to speed up our bodily physiology the way we're speeding up, say, technology, but we don't work like that way. Mm. And that's why so many people now, I guess, are going into that idea of we need to get back to nature. We need to, you know, slow down a little bit. We need to unplug ourselves for a while because our bodies get overloaded from all of these signals that are coming in. And it's like we're short circuiting. Mm. And we're like, well, I can't cope with any more than that. And that's where a lot of people try and check out.
I wonder though, back to that point of not to belabor this point, but that philosophical like choice, that binary choice.
Yes.
Like, so you asked the question, right? Are we safe right now? And to some extent you can ask the question, well, how do we define safe, right? Obviously in a physical sense,
yes,
it seems as if you and I are both very safe right now. But
yes,
I could go into my mind and start thinking like, well, how do I define safe? Is there some sense of fear of not living up to my potential or not achieving the things I need to achieve or not being able to take care of my family for some reason, right? And you can make an argument that says all those things are understandable, but the right approach is to put it in the right perspective and say that you'll still be better off if you kind of follow what we're talking about here. But I wonder if that doesn't bring us back to that decision where we either have to turn off our, the reason I'm concerned about am I living up to my potential, that allows me to be ambitious. That allows me to drive myself and push myself and be motivated and create out of that fear. There comes some fuel in that. If I turn that off and say, hey, I'm safe right now, like I could just slow down. I'm not saying this in a negative way. Does that also turn off that ambition? Does that not allow me then to go out and achieve those things? How do you, and I don't disagree, but how do you know that's not the case?
So again, we have two motivators. We have away from motivators, which is what you're talking about. Yeah. We're getting away because we're fear. We're not good enough. And again, if you listen to the stories that are sitting behind that, I'm not ambitious enough. It's I'm not enough. I'm not safe. I'm not lovable. I'm not lovable unless I get to this point. I can't be happy until I get here. I'm not going to be successful until I get to this. Because if you stop and you look at yourself right now and you think of everything you've achieved, I mean, one, you're still alive, you know.
Good, yeah.
Considering the alternative. You know, that's already a pretty good tick, you know. I stop and I look at where I am right now. And I'll use me as the example because of that. I have enough money for today. I've got enough to get through. I've got enough to keep the roof over my head, to keep the lights on for today. I have enough to put food on my table today. That is richer than goodness knows how much. So my ambitions of, you know, bringing more peace, bringing more love, bringing more self-acceptance, you know, I don't need to go any further than what I'm doing today. Am I taking steps towards taking the message further? Of course, I'm talking to you. Mm-hmm. And then later today, I'm actually going and doing my first aid course, which is, again, taking steps to make sure that I'm going to be covered by my insurance so that I can keep serving my clients. It's like we get so enmeshed in the noise. Now, the way I sort of think about it, and there isn't a binary, I don't believe there's ever binary. We want to go to binary because, again, it's easier. Black, white, yes, no, right, wrong, good, bad. You know, but we can only have, you know, say, for example, I'm seen as a tall woman, but I can only be seen as a tall woman if I'm standing either next to somebody short. But if I'm standing next to somebody, you know, who, I don't know, an NBL basketball player, I'm not going to be seen as a tall woman. Because I'm being compared. Right. Now, when we're standing on our own, where's that comparison? And so, again, if we can start coming out of that binary thinking and realize that there are so many multiple truths. Mm. In my book, I actually write about the fact that the truth has 144 sides. Mm. Now, I heard that quote, and it was one of those that's like, whoa. Because if we start thinking like that, then our right and wrong is only seen from one of those tiny perspectives. So what other perspectives are there on that truth? Because, you know, some people look at me and think I'm this, you know, I don't know, wildly successful person, yet I'm looking at other people going, oh my God, them, and oh my God, them. And so where is that finite idea? So again, you know, and what are we running away from? Often we're running away from ourselves because I'm not worthy. I'm not loved. I'm not good enough. So therefore I need more success to be loved enough. And I need more of this to be loved enough. And I need more of this to be happy enough. And I need more of this.
What is your motivation for success? Like, so as you said, you've achieved a lot of things. I've got the chance to listen to you on another podcast too. I know the amount of work you put in and the amount of time you put in to get to the place you are and the certifications and all the knowledge you've gained. That takes a lot of motivation. That takes a lot of drive. right?
Yeah.
If not, and I believe you that it's not from fear, it's not from insecurity. Mm. What is it that pushes you to do that versus just being at peace and saying, I don't need to take that other class, or I don't need to do this other thing?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a great question. I think this, and this is where it goes from that fear motivation, the away from motivation, to the to motivation. Mm. What am I moving to? I'm moving towards a better world. I'm moving towards more love, more peace, more joy, more happiness, more connection, more community. And so for me, my motivations now go towards the two rather than away from. I'm not moving away from pain. I am moving towards something better. Now, the away from pain is sometimes a really great way to start. It's how I started. I was like, life cannot be this crap. I cannot hate myself this much. Like, this is not healthy. And showing my kids this, really? That's not great. And so it's really for me about looking at towards what do I want to create? What do I want to leave behind for my children to inherit as a world? How can I bring more love, more peace, more joy into this world? How can I know myself deeply enough that I'm not passing on my unresourceful behaviors to the generations that follow?
Is there no
and not just for me, but why?
Is there no burden in that of to leave that better life for your kids to achieve those things? Is there not any pressure that you feel in that that gets to start to feel like you're running away from something again, or that there's fear? It's fear based.
No, not really. It's interesting, and you know, maybe if you'd asked me the question a few months ago, it might be a different answer. And again, there might be a different answer tomorrow. And that's the beauty of the, I guess, that evolution. You know, some days I guess there is fear because there is that, holy crap, am I going to have enough money to, you know, make ends meet at the end of the month, or, you know, whatever it is. You know, how many times have I said life cannot run on sunshine and moonbeams alone? I need cold hard cash to be able to do what I'm doing, and that's just a reality check. But again, I think it's about doing what I can. Mm. So I may have the big lofty vision, you know, out in front of me. I know what I want to feel. I know what I want to do. But if I keep my eyes on that all the way in the future of this is how I want to feel, this is how I want to be, that gets overwhelming, because between where I am now and that is a hell of a lot of noise. There's a lot of what ifs, there's a lot of fear, there's a lot of uncertainty, because we don't know. So my idea is I get a really clear picture of where I'm heading, but then I'm looking at what's the next step. And they're my two focal points. What is the step I can take now that is going to move me closer to that? And then occasionally I look behind me to go, what's holding me back from that? But I don't want to stand looking back and going, oh, these are all my traumas. You know, here's all of this patterning, and, you know, let me see what else I can clear. Because if I don't know where I'm moving to,
then you just
I could be here forever. Because there's always going to be a new level to clear. And let's face it, when we also then look into, I don't know, past lives or generational conditioning, you know, you could be looking backwards forever. And I think this is the difference of a lot of people, that a lot of people get stuck in when they're in that healing space. They're not quite clear on where they're going. They don't quite know their next step. And so they're spending all their time looking at this. I really like getting people to get this really clear vision of where do you want to go? Even if you don't know where, how do you want to feel? Mm. So how do you get to move closer towards feeling those feelings? Mm. And then, okay, what's your next step? What's the step you can take right now to get you closer to that? And then what's holding you back from achieving that? Because I think that forward motion, I know in parts of my healing journey, I've been stuck looking in the past. Because I know it's been part of what I've needed to do. But there can often be, that blame and that lack of peace, because you're like, seriously, have I not moved past this yet? You know, and I'm not talking about blame or lack of peace for other people, but for yourself, because you're constantly looking back at the past and, oh, I could have done that better, or I should have done that. And yes, there's lessons and learning in that, but I think if we stay stuck in it, where they're not moving forward. So we really need to get that balance right of where am I going? What's my next step? What's holding me back from that?
Mm. And it truly is a progression, it sounds like, where it's not the same for everybody, but it starts
and not linear.
Yeah, exactly. Not linear and not the same. But for a lot of people, I would imagine they start with, I don't want to look back. I don't want to look at those traumas. They're uncomfortable. They scare me. I don't want to face it. I'm just going to make pretend it didn't happen and move forward. And that obviously doesn't work.
Yes.
Then your next step is you start looking at it. And that's good, right? You're moving in the right
direction.
But it's not the end game, as you're saying. Then you have to take that next step in the progression and say, okay, I'm leaving those back there now and moving forward, which I like. I like a lot. Let me ask this question. You touched on it before. How do you ensure in this process that it doesn't become too selfish, for lack of a better word? And I know it's an important word. I've heard you talk about it before, because people get triggered by selfish. They assume that's a negative thing flat out. And it's not. Yeah. It's just a word that means you're caring for yourself, right? So there should be some selfishness. But inevitably, there usually is a line where you could go too far and worry too much. In a process that is so focused on you and where you want to be and dealing with those traumas, which is all good stuff, how do you stop yourself from going too far down that and not thinking about other people and only worrying about yourself in that?
Well, I think if you're looking at what's in the highest good of you, it can't be selfish. Because what's in the highest good of you? Because let's face it, we are all still connected. We are all still part of the one. We're part of the microcosm that make up this planet. You know, I describe it to clients, you know, if you imagine a big tapestry, you know, if one string gets pulled out, you notice that it's gone. You know, and the idea of life, I guess, is as one soul leaves, another one's coming in. And so that string continues through. But if you just take a string out, you're missing something. We are all needed, and we can't, you know, we're all part of that fabric of life. And so if we look at what's in our highest good, not what's in what do I want to do right now, but what's in my highest good. When I ask myself that question, I don't always get what I want to do. But I get what's in my highest good, what's best for me to do. The other idea with, you know, the selfishness, it is really interesting, actually, because I used to think that selfishness is what you did that, you know, discounted or just disregarded other people and often caused hurt and harm. And so I, you know, thought, well, we've got to be selfless. We're taught to be selfless. That is seen as the pinnacle, especially for women, of what we should be in this world. But selflessness does what it says on the tin. We are making less and less and less and less of ourselves. We are often putting ourselves in an inferior position and everybody else in a superior position. And therefore we go into that people-pleasing mode of let me do it for you, you know, rescuing, helping, fixing, and people-pleasing, often to the detriment of ourselves, making less and less and less of who we are. And we get caught in those resentment spirals of I'm bloody doing everything. And what are you, you know, what's everyone else doing? And it's a toxic cycle. But then we look at selfishness, and it was interesting. I heard Abraham Hicks speak about it. And they said, you think about whoever has called you selfish in the past. It's usually someone who has wanted something from you that you either aren't going to give or are not prepared to give or cannot give them. So who in that situation is actually selfish? And it has retrained my idea on selfishness, because I'm like, wow, actually every time I've called somebody else selfish, it is. It's because I wanted something of them that they're not giving me, or they're not prepared to give me, or they're never going to give me. And I think the idea of being self-full is a better idea. Filling up our own cup, taking care of our needs, identifying our needs and wants. And asking for help when we need to, allowing ourselves to give to ourselves and receive from ourselves what we truly need at a deeper level. I think it is hard to be selfish in that situation, because we are in service to other people. We're being of service, I should say. Being in service, again, I sort of see that as in servitude, but being of service to other people. When we are living a life of service, we are in that equality. We are working with other people. We're in that power with and power to, not power over structure, which gives everybody that power. In me looking after myself, my children get a better quality of mother. They may not get me as much, but when we are together, it is so much more relaxed and calm and loving and connective, because we're fully present with each other. Now, before, when they used to get me, and we laugh about it often, I would be short and sharp and snappy and grumpy and distracted when I was with them.
And that's when you were being selfish.
Because I was trying to do, exactly. because I was giving to everybody else. I had nothing for me. And then it was like, oh, and here's somebody else wanting to suck the life out of me. You know, you feel like they're little parasites, and I don't want my children feeling like that. You know, but now because I look after myself, I am able to give more effortlessly and with much more ease.
It is because it's such a nuanced thing, though, because finding that balance between doing right by others, but doing right by yourself, and you don't want them to feel like parasites. Obviously, you want to care for them, but you know, in doing that, you need to care for yourself. You can understand why it's so hard for so many people. And there's an assumption in it. There's an implicit assumption, I think, or maybe explicit assumption, as you're stating it, that this belief that at our core, our reason for being here is that interconnectedness, is to be of service to others. That is our highest self, right?
Yes.
Is it possible that there are people on this planet who that's not the highest version of themselves? And I'm asking that genuinely. I'm not suggesting that it is or isn't. Like, is it possible that for some people, their optimal life is not giving to others, is not being of service? Or is it your view, and maybe it's a spiritual, maybe it's religious, whatever we want to call it, that like actually those people just have it wrong? We are on this planet, we are in this universe, we are interconnected in such a way that we, by definition, our highest self is to be of service to others. Is that an assumption that we're comfortable saying is true for everybody? And anybody that's not there, they're just not there yet on the journey, but ideally they'll get there. Is that the way to look at it?
I sort of take it back to a really, I guess, simple analogy. And I believe everybody has a higher self. And I believe that higher self knows the highest expression of that person. I also believe that not all of us are tapped into it either through trauma or conditioning or whatever. I don't believe that anybody wakes up in the morning and goes, gee, you know what, I'm going to be an asshole today. You know, I don't think it's a deliberate choice for most people. Potentially psychopaths and sociopaths would get there. But even then, I don't think they think in that way that, oh, gee, I'm going to go and do this today and I'm going to harm some people. And isn't that
can I ask about that? I mean, just to, and then I'll let you keep building. But what if somebody wakes up and says, I don't know, whatever, I love having sex with women or men or whatever it is, and I want to do that today. And they're not thinking of it in the negative, but we know like there's an implication that you may mistreat people. You might be a womanizer. You might, you know.
That's their conditioning. And who are we to judge that, really?
Okay, right.
I mean, and I guess that's where it comes back to it. Can we look at them with love and actually understand that that is the only expression of themselves they understand?
But that's
it's not the only expression that there is, yeah.
Okay.
Everybody has that highest expression. Everybody has that because we are souls in human bodies. It's the human conditioning that comes in over the top and the past traumatic experiences that get lodged in the body that create these ways of being and these ways of behavior. And I truly believe that, you know, the way I sort of describe it, you know, when I see people acting unresourcefully, I actually see them in this. I still remember the little outfit. My son used to have these little gray overalls and he had this blue and green top, like little striped collared t-shirt, looked super cute, super smart. And my mum was putting something together in the garden for me one day. And, you know, obviously she's got the tools out. So he runs and grabs his little Fisher-Price toolkit. And I'm not giving a plug to Fisher-Price. Other toolkits are available, by the way. And so he's bringing these big plastic tools to try and do big grown-up jobs. Now, it's not going to work. Yeah, you're not going to be able to build a beautiful house. Now, I know, and again, other, you know, there's a massive hardware store near us. I know that I can get everything from that hardware store to build myself a beautiful big mansion. And I don't know all of those tools yet, but I know that this magical place exists and that if I learn how to use those things, I'm going to have the most incredible mansion within me. Now, some people will go into that hardware store and go, I'm only going to look at the paints and that's the bit I'm happy with. Some people will just go into the gardening section. Some people will just go into, you know, they'll walk straight past the power tools. I'm not qualified for those, you know, and if I'd handed my son a power tool at 18 months old, he would have hurt himself, you know, and so he was only qualified to use those Fisher-Price tools. So, you know, some people drive past that big hardware store and go, it's not for me. Others won't even see it because it's out of there. And that's the way I think about the spiritual tools, the personal development tools. not everyone's ready for them. Not everyone wants to see them. Not everyone even knows they exist. Mm. But everyone just has the toolkit that they have. And so some people are walking through life with their little, you know, in their dungarees and their, you know, little t-shirt with their little childhood toolkit. And that's how they're trying to get through life. And when I look at people in that kind of way, understanding that they only have the tools they have, whether they're looking for more or not actually isn't a judgment I can make, but with the tools they have in that moment, it helps me bring out more love and compassion for them.
Empathy, yeah.
Because I can see that they're just doing the best they can in any moment. And let's face it, every single one of us is only doing the best we can in that moment. Because if we're not, we'd be doing better or different.
Mm.
Because who we decide better or worse.
Yeah, I believe that.
And that's the bit that I guess I'm working towards, because it is a work in progress. You know, someone cuts me off in the car, I still go, you know, get frustrated. I'm still a work in progress myself. I catch that little bit of frustration. I'm like, whoa, hang on. You don't know what's happening for them today. But again, that's been a work in progress as well.
Yeah.
Of me to be able to re-catch that and go, hang on a minute. You know, they may not have seen me. They may have been distracted. Who knows what's going on? They may just be pissed off.
Like, that's you going from a little plastic Fisher-Price hammer to like a teen, you know, 15-year-old. They would use that hammer. You have that now. And that self-mastery that you started with, that value of you upskilling over and over till you get to that craftsman hammer that allows you to cut off in traffic and say, I wish that person didn't do that, but, you know, they must have something going on and I'm not going to let it ruin my day.
Exactly. So,
all right. So let me ask this question as we come to the end. That confidence to know that what our souls are and our highest self and what it's meant to be, where does that come from for you? What is that rooted in? Is it religion? Is there a belief in God in some form? Is it intuitive where you just feel like it has to be true? Like, how would you articulate the confidence you have in that higher self that we should all be kind of working or are trying to get to? We're all doing our best towards it.
I think, you know, it started off with religion. When I was young, we were raised in the church and, you know, for me, again, people got in the way. People and dogma and, you know, judgment got in the way of supposedly this non-judgmental, loving teacher. And so I did move away from the church for a long time, and it took me a long time to be able to call, you know, source or creator God. It took me a long time to be able to go back to that. So now I guess it does come from that sense of my experience with spirituality, my experience with God, my personal experience with, you know, Mother Earth and nature, my personal experience with that thing that is greater than me, call it creator, source, the universe, God, goddess, you know, whatever you want to call it. And I use all of those terms interchangeably, but all of it is about that higher power than me. You know, and I say it to my clients, you know, well, let's face it, if I'm the highest power there is, we're all screwed. Likewise, if you are, you know, there has to be a higher power who's actually overseeing this big game we call life.
Does it have
there
to
just
be?
Has to be. Does I there think there has to be. For me, there has to be. It's a faith thing for me, because let's face it, if we are the highest thing there is, then we're all in trouble, because we have these human, this human fallibility. And, you know, even if it's just a puppet master just having a big game up there, who knows? But for me, it really helps to believe in that higher power. And I can tell you now, I walk the beach every day with my dog. And walking on that beach and seeing the sun come up every day proves to me that there's a higher power. Seeing that wonder and awe, seeing something so perfect, even on a crappy day like today, we've got, it'll be rough as hell down there this morning, but even in that there is beauty and there has to be some, I didn't create it, so there has to be a higher power. You know, you didn't create it, there has to be something higher than us humans to be able to create something that phenomenally breathtaking.
You're touching on such an interesting topic for me, and we won't deep dive into it, I don't think. But it's something that I grapple with so much. I've talked about it on previous shows. So much of what you're saying, I could feel it. I could feel it literally in me, and I hear it and it resonates and I get it. There's this other part of me, right? Left brain, right brain, whatever you want to call it, that says, you said a word, you said prove, it proves to me it's there, right? And then I know you're saying, and I think you mean that, right? It does. It literally, But there's a logical part of my brain that says, well, it doesn't prove it. Like, it's still, there's a chance it's not. There's a chance that sun came up because of some literal biological reason. And I'm not saying that's conclusive, but I grapple with this so much. And it ultimately comes down to this idea of faith, right? Yeah. And faith is perhaps the most fascinating concept in the world to me, because in effect, what it's saying is, believe something that you can't explain. Believe something that your mind is incapable of explaining and understanding, and you could never know for sure is true, but act as if it is.
Yeah. And
it also gets this interesting concept of the functionality of that, right? Like, and I think often when you hit that highest level, you start to realize, well, maybe that is God, because you believing that, even if you can't explain it exactly to me, has allowed you to achieve beautiful things in your life. It's allowed you to embrace life in a way that you wouldn't have otherwise. It's allowed you to care for your kids in a different way. And if that's not beautiful, if that's not some ability for a higher power of the universe to get you to get to your higher self, well, then what would it look like? What would it be? Yeah. So I kind of talk myself into circles of being, like, I don't know if it's real, but then actually but maybe it is.
If you think about science, what is science? Science is trying to prove the unprovable that you think might be provable. Mm-hmm. You know, I know penicillin was kind of, you know, one of those things that was created by accident, but oh my God, like, look at this thing that we've just created. We'll prove that it works. Okay, so now we do the work to prove that it works. You know, whatever those science things are, okay, so I've got this massive idea. You know, somebody had to think about the internet before there was the internet. Somebody had to think about computers before there were computers. You know, there's all of these leaps and jumps that because people started to think about this potentiality of what could exist and then went about trying to prove it. Science and spirituality aren't that far apart, and yet they pretend they're opposite ends of the spectrum. And they try and, you know, fight each other and deny each other and argue with each other. And it's like, you know what, guys, if you sat down, you'd realize you had a hell of a lot more in common than have apart.
Your sisters or whatever you want to call it, it's on the side of the same coin. I believe that. I believe that. I do believe that. And that's one of the things through this journey of mine and, you know, this 130 or so episodes I've done now, that's one of my biggest takeaways from this, is that how closely connected spirituality and science are. And I was one of those people that would have said, you know, a year, two, 3 years ago, no, they're diametrically opposed. Yep. But they're so interconnected and related. I believe that. Well, Amanda, listen, these are the conversations I love. I mean, not only getting to learn more about you and your way of thinking and your approach to life and your value system, but to also in this like intellectually rigorous way, kind of think through it and say, well, what about that? How does this work? Cause that's where learning happens. That's where we unlock new things, and it helps us move up and gain that self-mastery. So I can't thank you enough for being on, for the work you're doing, for your perspective. I really, really enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I love your energy. So it's just been amazing. The warmth that you exude is just it's lovely. So
I will put
thank
a link
you
to the
for
book.
Bringing your work into the world.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I will definitely put a link to the book. And my hope is always with these conversations that people hear you in long form and how you think and be like, I need to hear more. Let me see. Let me read the book and figure it out. So the name of the book is
Divine Messy Human.
Yeah. In that order. I know that order. So I will put a link to that so people can learn more about what you've learned, your wisdom, your experiences, and how you're trying to help others. But again, Amanda, thanks so much for being on.
Thank you. It's been wonderful.
All right. You have a great rest of your day.
We'll catch you soon. You too. Bye-bye. Bye.